Welcome back to Restless Viking Radio. This is Season 1, Episode 6, the third chapter in the Cape Jones story. This episode takes place before the destination, before the asking, and before the answer. It's about a crossing, a gathering, and the moment when visitors stop being watched and start being weighed. Let me take you to Fort George Island. Before we ever reached Cape Jones, before we even met the men who would decide whether we were going, we tried to find a ride. But first, we were tested. This is the story of Mamuidao, the place where memory dances, and where being accepted starts with being embarrassed. We met them on the road before the ferry. A group of men on expedition motorcycles, mirrored visors down, dust-caked gear, cameras mounted to their helmets like antennas. The road narrowed at a bend, and we had to pass each other slowly. They saw us, but didn't acknowledge us. Eyes straight ahead, faces hidden behind the tinted glass of their helmets. It wasn't hostility, it was theater. The practiced indifference of men who'd ridden far enough north to believe they were the story. They wanted to be seen, not seeing us. And I wasn't offended. I actually felt sorry for them. They had come all this way to skim the surface of something real and never touch it. By the time we reached the ferry landing, their engines had already faded into the wind. We rolled forward toward the riverbank, a jumble of vehicles, gear, and a mountain of supplies strapped every which way. A pair of Cree girls stood near the gravel edge, maybe 10 years old, watching our slow procession with quiet appraisal. The kind of look that said, "Now who are these people?" I leaned out the window, trying to wear my most humble mask. "Do we just wait in line here?" I asked the older of the two, both of them clearly in charge of the situation. She didn't miss a beat. It was as if she'd been waiting for me to ask. "You have to do it backwards," she said, in the firm, certain tone of someone who'd seen this show before. As if to amplify her point, she made a small, deliberate hand signal, a looping turn of her wrist, awkward like a child but commanding like a director. "Thanks," I said, genuinely relieved to have someone who actually knew what was going on. I grabbed the radio. "All right, team, looks like we'll be doing this backwards," I announced, trying not to sound like I had just been schooled by a 10-year-old. I swung the Jeep around and began backing toward the water. The wind howled across the river, kicking up bits of gravel and flapping tarp straps. The others in the convoy followed suit, tires crunching, dust swirling in the air. The ferry approached like a stubborn animal, fighting the wind but never losing stride. It rammed gently against the gravel landing, dropping its ramp while still moving, and started unloading passengers who hopped off before it had even settled. The two vehicles on board rumbled down the ramp, and then it was our turn. A man in a high-visibility vest appeared in my mirror, motioning impatient for me to back up. I followed his hand signals, quick, sharp, and absolute. The Jeep bounced onto the deck, and he waved me into the far corner, inches from the railing. The wind suddenly blasted through my open window as he squeezed past, already signaling for the next vehicle. Lark, call sign reroute, wasn't as lucky. Her approach drew a theatrical series of hand gestures from the deckhand that grew in size and intensity until they resembled an orchestra conductor in distress. Then, without ceremony, the man stomped to her window, leaned halfway into the cab, and physically turned her steering wheel himself. It looked less like guidance and more like repossession. Lark sat frozen, wide-eyed. He'd barked something over the wind, pointed to a spot, and stepped away. She corrected perfectly. He gave a curt nod that might have been a compliment. In this part of the world, that seemed to count as affection. When the last vehicle was aboard, a dump truck rumbled on behind us. The ferry spun itself free from the shore, engines roaring, and began its short charge across La Grande River. Half a mile later, we nosed up to the gravel landing of Fort George Island. The place looked like a forgotten town after a storm, windblown, half buried in sand. Empty houses leaned into the wind, roads disappeared under drifts of sand. Fort George had once been home to the Cree nation of Chisasibi. Then came 1981, and Hydro-Quebec's massive diversion project. The engineers said the island would erode. The government said the community had to move. 200 houses crossed the river to the mainland. And yet, decades later, the island still stands, windblown but unbroken, left to the wind, not the water. We were here for Mamuidao, the gathering where the Cree returned to the island each year to remember, to dance, to hold on. We parked and continued on foot toward the cluster of buildings near the main tent. The wind pushed through the grass and sand, carrying the distant rhythm of a fiddle. A few people in reflective vests moved between tables in a small office, what looked like a coordination point for the event. It kind of felt like a gateway to the celebration itself, the place where the quiet island gave way to movement and sound. A handful of teenagers were lounged nearby, sitting on porch railings and leaning against posts, watching us approach, with the kind of expression teenagers everywhere have mastered, curiosity disguised as apathy. One asked where we were from, another wanted to know what we were doing there. Their tone wasn't rude, just cautious. They nodded when I answered, then returned to their performance of being unimpressed. A few hundred feet beyond, laughter drifted from the big field. And that's where the day truly began for us. A few of the braver kids approached first, then more joined in, until we were surrounded. A swirl of small faces, bright eyes, and endless questions. They asked where we were from, and we said Michigan. They tilted their heads, puzzled. For them, South was a rumor, not a place. One boy, maybe 10, asked if I was a warrior. I hesitated, then said, I used to be. His eyes widened. He turned to his friends and they scattered, shouting to one another like they'd just met a legend. So, there we were, 10 white adults in the middle of a loose, laughing swarm of Cree kids, teaching games we half remembered, learning new ones we didn't know the names of, cameras and phones passed hands, a ball rolled back and forth. Questions were traded. And for a while, no one bothered to explain who belonged where. As early afternoon unfolded, the sound of the fiddle pulled us toward the giant white tent. Inside, the light was soft and milky through the canvas. Bleachers circled a huge plywood dance floor rising steeply toward the back. We climbed high, finding seats near the top with a good view of everything. At one end stood a stage where an older Cree woman with an energetic voice announced the goings-on in Cree. We didn't understand a word, but her tone carried everything. Authority, humor, warmth. And then a band took the stage, a stout young fiddler, a guitarist, and a bassist. The fiddle sprang to life, bright and sharp. The sound cut through the tent. I couldn't help myself. I left our high perch and made my way down to a lower bleacher seat, closer to the floor so I could record the music. I sat there filming, caught up in the rhythm when the music stopped as abruptly as it had began. The announcer said something in Cree, then a flash of white out of the corner of my eye. A woman in a sweatshirt reached out, grabbed my arm, and yanked hard. Her smile was nervous, but her grip wasn't. She hauled me off the bench and toward the floor with a strength that didn't invite debate. I looked back at my crew for help. They were already standing, phones out, grinning, not a rescuer among them. I followed, confused, a little anxious and reluctant. I hadn't square danced since elementary school. The fiddler stood ready but silent as the announcer scanned the crowd. Then through the loudspeaker, she spoke English for the first time. "Where are you from?" I didn't react right away. The words hung in the air, lost in a quiet murmur of the crowd. My partner, still gripping my arm, gave it a light slap and pointed toward the stage. The announcer repeated herself, louder this time. I blinked, still a little dazed, looked around, and finally yelled back, "Michigan!" "Oh," she cried, drawing out the word with theatrical delight. "The land of the long knives!" The crowd erupted in laughter. My partner laughed too, giving me a small nod. "You're in it now." Then the announcer leaned into the mic again. "Let's see if the long knife can dance." And with that, the fiddle leapt to life. The band launched into a wild, bright rhythm and the floor filled instantly. It was a square dance, the kind every woman in the tent seemed to know by muscle memory. And the men followed in varying degrees of commitment, some smiling, half trying. I was already in deep, spinning and sidestepping with more confusion than grace when I saw Rich and Doug getting pulled from their seats by new partners. Both were big bearded guys, and the Cree woman clearly had a strategy. Start with the biggest targets. Within a few minutes, more of the crew were yanked from the bleachers and folded into the fray. The rest of our team, mostly the women, stayed safely in the stands, laughing so hard they could barely hold their phone steady. One of them was doubled over, gasping for breath between fits of laughter. The music picked up. The steps came fast. Spin, change, back again. My partner led me with a patience that bordered on heroic. 7 minutes in, I thought we were wrapping up, but we weren't. Beads of sweat rolled down my neck. Somewhere in the chaos, a toddler wandered onto the floor. I didn't see him until my boot clipped him and he went down. Everything inside me froze. I stopped, scooped him up, and set him gently back on his feet. He gave me a quick look, maybe a glare, maybe confusion, and then sprinted off into the storm of legs like a gust of wind. Rich lost his footing, went down, popped back up like nothing happened. The crowd roared. The announcer, our mischievous mistress of ceremonies, occasionally tossed in another, "Long knives!" just to keep the laughter rolling. 14 minutes later, it ended. Or maybe I just stopped moving. We bowed to our partners and the tent filled with applause. My teammates cheered like they just watched a bullfight. They were still laughing as we stumbled back to the bleachers, red-faced and soaked. I got the feeling we'd been tested, and I think we might have passed. The ice was broken. Later, an elder told me that square dancing came north with Hudson's Bay traders centuries ago, and the Cree had made it theirs. And then we wandered outside and through an open field where elders carved paddles and bowls, their knives whispering against the grain. Smoke curled from small fires mingling with the smell of bannock and Labrador tea. We stepped into a few teepees where food was being served, pancakes folded around strips of meat, bannock still warm from the pan, tea poured from blackened kettles into mismatched mugs. Inside one of the teepees, a group of elder women sat together, steady and self-assured, speaking softly in Cree. When I poured their tea, they didn't thank me at first. They simply expected it. Not in arrogance, but in order. It was my place, as a younger one, to serve the elders. I fetched milk, cream, and sugar, taking quiet pride in doing it right. Only after I'd set everything before them did they acknowledge me. A small nod, a faint smile, and a soft thank you. That was when I understood. I wasn't being kind. I was being respectful. In their world, those weren't the same thing. They didn't see me as an outsider fumbling through good manners. They saw me as a man doing what he was supposed to do. And they were gently thankful, as though I remembered something I was meant to know all along. It charmed me, that quiet certainty. I don't think they even realized how naturally they carried it. Nearby, an older man explained the foods, which plants belonged to which season, which dishes were made for gatherings and which were for journeys. He spoke of tradition as if it were a living companion always beside him. I listened greedily, trying to absorb it all, the rhythm of his speech, the way knowledge was passed, not as instruction but as story. Later, we made our way toward the cafeteria, a low, wind-worn building that offered both traditional food and the universal staples of every community event, hot dogs, chips, and coffee in styrofoam cups. The team spread out among the long tables, mixing naturally with the Cree families already seated. I struck up a conversation with a woman about my age while Amy, Barb, and Robert sat nearby listening and responding with quiet smiles and nods. When she asked where we were from, I said Michigan. Her eyes brightened. I lived in Sault Ste. Marie, she said. I leaned in. Across the river from us then. She paused for a moment, then said softly, I went to the residential school there. Her voice was calm, almost conversational. Most of us did. The words carried farther than her voice. Others nearby turned toward us, listening, and soon more joined in, not loud, not angry, just steady. She told me she'd been about 8 when she was taken to the residential school in Sault Ste. Marie. They cut her hair the first day. To make us clean, they told her. We weren't allowed to speak Cree. When we did, punishment came fast. Some were beaten. Some were tied to their beds. Some were locked alone until the crying stopped. They said they wanted to kill the Indian and the child, she said. The cafeteria hum fell away until there was nothing but their voices, level and unshaken. They told how the other girls protected the younger ones, how they whispered their language under blankets at night, how laughter had to hide. When someone was caught speaking Cree, they scrubbed their mouth with soap to wash out the words. They didn't cry. They didn't accuse. They simply told it, like people who had carried the story long enough to make peace with its weight. They knew we hadn't done these things. That wasn't the point. The point was that we understood. She looked around the cafeteria, then toward the great white tent outside, the sound of the fiddle still drifting across the island. Now we dance, she said. We laugh where they told us not to speak. For a long time, no one moved. The only sound was the wind pressing against the old windows, as if the island itself was listening in. Mama Weedow wasn't performance. It wasn't tourism, it was memory, alive, stubborn, and unbroken. And before we could go any further north, before we could ask for anything, we had to learn how to stand still and listen. Next time, we return to Chisasibi, and we meet the men who sit. I'm Chuck. This is Restless Viking Radio.